Hurricane Katrina destroy the infrastructure of New Orleans and the lives of its residents, and also its criminal justice system. Police stations and courts were ruined, essential files were lost, and many of the people that ran the system were displaced. Now, over 2 years after the hurricane, the criminal justice system is up and running, but it's faced with serious problems, and the city remains the most violent in the United States. Joining me now is Michael Jacobson, a former New York City Corrections Commissioner and now director of the Vera Institute of Justice, which recently submitted a report to the New Orleans City Council on what can be done to reform its criminal justice system. It is my great pleasure to welcome Mr. Jacobson to my show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Was your institute asked by officials in New Orleans to come down and see what can be done to reform the criminal justice system?
Yeah, we got an invitation from the city council a number of months ago to come down, sort of take a look at what was going on, do a sort of diagnostic, essentially, and see what we might be able to recommend, both in the sort of short and midterm, as steps they could start to take to rebuild their system.
And I assume you did a lot of interviewing.
Yeah, we talked to a number of the sort of stakeholders, the people in the criminal justice system, the sort of city leadership, the city council, judges, community groups, and advocates. So we got and have a pretty good sense of what's happening and what the big barriers are.
And what is happening?
Well, you know, they're in the middle of rebuilding the physical infrastructure is still a huge problem. Resources are a gigantic problem. As you said, the homicides in particular are a sort of huge and haunting problem.
What's being called the murder capital of the United States.
Right. Well, on a per capita basis now, especially because so many people left and didn't return, their per capita murder rate is very high. So the pressures on the system from just the infrastructure, from resources, from crime are just tremendous and they're daunting.
I'm assuming that they called you in because they didn't want to return to the way it was before Katrina.
Right. Well, in some ways, in the city council, and particularly James Carter, who's the city council person who's really leading this from the council, had this notion, which I think is correct, that it, you know, as devastating as Katrina was, this was and is an opportunity to rebuild to a better system, ultimately. And you just didn't want to rebuild to what you had before, but you wanted to make it better. And I think that's right. And, you know, hopefully the road that's the road that everyone's going to go down.
Well, as far as I understand, there was rampant corruption in the old days. Of course, you don't want to rebuild to that.
Well, exactly. And not just corruption and inefficiency. And, you know, it's a poor state. You know, so resources are always an issue. And, you know, so the, you know, if you spend too much time thinking about the problems and the obstacles, you know, you'll get too overwhelmed. I think we've been encouraged by the sort of willingness to undertake reform and understanding that reforms are necessary, and that everyone sort of realizes this is, you know, it's hard work to do this. Even in the best case, it's never neat, it's never tidy, it always takes longer than you think. But I think everyone is in a good position here.
Is it possible to eliminate corruption in a place where it has been so endemic?
I doubt it. And certainly, you know, Vera isn't going to eliminate corruption. I think what we can do is try to help them sort of think through what systems make sense, what systems are in everyone's not only sort of self-interest in terms of their institutional roles, but that are in the interest of the citizens in the city. And then that will go a long way to dealing with, you know, a lot of the issues. But are we going to make it a utopia? No.
My guest is Michael Jacobson, who was New York City Correction Commissioner from 1995 to 1998, now the director of the Vera Institute of Justice. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In what ways was the criminal justice system damaged by the hurricane? I mean, on a physical level?
Oh, yeah, sure. Certainly on a physical level. I mean, even now when you visit the police chief there, they're in trailers. The sheriff is in trailers. The DA's offices are sort of a mess, as are the public defenders. I mean, excuse me, the physical infrastructure was so damaged, and it's so important as part of this reform, not only to sort of change your systems, but get people back into sort of livable space that people and citizens can respect.
Have most of the major players in the criminal justice system returned to the city to reclaim their jobs?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, certainly at the heads, you know, the DA, the police chiefs, the judges, I mean, they're all back and functioning. You know, the police department, which was down many, many hundreds of people, is now back up. I think they're about either 400 or 500 fewer than they had. But that kind of rebuilding is certainly happening. And there's tremendous commitment of people in the system. The damage they had to ensue is almost unthinkable.
Where is the money for all of this coming from? Is the federal government providing the city with funds to rebuild the courts, the police stations, to hire more government workers?
Yeah, you know, there's some money for a variety of these things, but I think one of the things that we, along with the city, have to think through are where are we going to get additional funding streams. I mean, there's certainly funding streams to help rebuild the physical infrastructure and some funding streams for operations. But, you know, at the end of the day, when all this is over, the city is going to have to be able to support its own system along with the state. And what we're trying to help the city sort of do and think through and plan is, you know, what is the best way to have a system to make the most efficient use of the resources that you have?
Well, this is a sort of thing that maybe many cities wish they could go through, or at least people in different cities wish they could go through. But it takes something like a Hurricane Katrina to force a city to actually do it. Your institute seems to take a liberal approach to the problems of the U.S. criminal justice system, emphasizing alternative sentencing and detaining options. Was that something that the people in New Orleans wanted? Hadn't they had a kind of like a tougher approach to crime in the past?
Yeah, you know, and I think you're right at some level that some people think of that as liberal. You know, we think of that stuff as just good public safety policy, because what you want any system to do is to use its resources efficiently. So, for example, you don't want to use incarceration when you don't have to. So for lower-level offenders, for people who don't pose a risk to public safety, to people who could better serve the community by doing community service, that's what you want to do with them. And that's both better for public safety because, again, there's all sorts of research which shows that if you overpunish people who are low risk, you make them work. But the other reason it's good for public safety is it allows you to then focus the resources you have on the people that pose the most threat to public safety. So we don't think of these as particularly liberal or conservative. It's just good best practice that makes sense.
But as a former New York City corrections commissioner, you know how hard it is to fight the trend toward locking up more and more people. How do you deal with that when so many in the public and in government favor that over alternative sentencing?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When you look at national polls now, for example, you'll see that the American public actually has a lot more willingness to use alternatives to prison and jail for lower-level offenders, for nonviolent offenders, and especially for drug offenders, especially if some of the alternatives involve giving something back to the community. And we find that's true with even very conservative policymakers around the country.
But we don't hear this when people are running for office. They don't say, you know, I'm going to not be tough in crime in the old way. I'm not going to throw these guys in jail. We're going to try alternative approaches.
That's correct. And I myself have never heard anyone run for office saying we're going to beef up the community correction system. You know, on the other hand, where the place that policymakers find themselves in now is that resources are more and more scarce. There's more and more research and best practice that indicates that for certain kinds of offenders, alternatives to jail are much better than jail. And what that does allow both citizens and policymakers to do is concentrate resources on people that present the most threat to public safety. You can't just spend all your dollars incarcerating people, both because it takes away money from things that will get you more public safety, but also because it will just make certain people worse than they already are.
Are there enough jail cells to even do that in New Orleans?
I think they have enough jail cells that if they, and this is part of the work we're going to try to do, if they were able to sort of discriminate better than they do now, who might be released on their own recognizance or who might be released with community supervision and who might be better served by doing a week or two of community service rather than a week or two in jail, I think they probably ultimately will have enough jail cells to handle what they need. need.
Did you look to a particular criminal justice system as a model for what New Orleans can do? Are there cities in the U.S. that have, in your opinion, fair and equitable criminal justice systems?
Yeah, you know, what we tend to do, while there's sort of no shining example of, you know, here's a city that's just sort of national best practice in every single area, there is best practice all over the country in a variety of areas, right? So in pretrial release, for example, and having a sophisticated agency that can look at people who are being arrested, that can make determinations on their level of risk, that can make determinations about who's likely to reoffend and who might be better served in the community pending their trial. There are a variety of cities that have best practice. New York City actually happens to be one of those cities with our criminal justice agency that does that. Harris County in Texas, for example, does. So what we did is sort of isolate for various areas, whether they're community courts or pretrial service agencies or cities that have district attorneys and police talk early and often about their cases. We've used a lot of that best practice from all over the city, as opposed to just saying you should be just like New York, for example.
But I assume wherever those best practices have been employed, it took a certain amount of courage for people to make that step.
Well, both, you know, right. It involves a lot of things, both courage, resources, and the opportunity that once you've done it to see how it works, right, to start to see the value in some of this stuff. And as I said, you know, Texas has a lot of the best practice in
even
some
though
of
it
these
also
areas.
Has, even though it has the most capital punishment.
That's correct, right? So it's, you know, you can never sort of tell just based on what you assume sort of an ideology is or the politics of a state are, you know, who's going to have what best practice here. And, you know, again, as states and cities have more and more constrained resources, that actually allows for a more rational discussion of what in fact works around crime and public safety, not what in fact is good politics.
My guest is Michael Jacobson, who's director of the Vera Institute of Justice. He was the New York City Correction Commissioner from 1995 to 1998, and Vera was called in to recommend changes in the New Orleans system, criminal justice system. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. And we're back with Michael Jacobson, former New York City Correction Commissioner, now director of the Vera Institute of Justice, which has been advising New Orleans on how to make its criminal justice system better. We mentioned earlier that New Orleans is now being called the murder capital of the United States. Any theories as to why violent crime is on the rise there?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, there's clearly there are so many reasons, especially for a city like New Orleans. You know, the amount of concentrated poverty is still mind-boggling, and not just poverty, but really concentrated pockets of poverty. A lot of drug use, obviously, gang activity around that drug use, the sort of, you know, alienation and enmity that sort of set in after Katrina. I'm sure, I mean, there are a whole host of reasons. And again, it's hard in any case for a city to deal with something like that, and even harder for a city like New Orleans to deal with it.
Well, New York City, as we have learned recently, despite its pockets of poverty and other problems, has been reducing its crime rate way below the national average. So are there other factors? Is policing still a problem in New Orleans?
Well, you know, and in some ways, New York City is a good example just because it continues to lower its crime rate, and that's a wonderful thing. And not just New Orleans, which is a little bit off the charts, but, you know, a lot of big cities now are seeing an uptick in crime. So New York City is really the exception here. And, you know, again, one of the things that differentiates New York City is that we have, you know, certainly one of the best police departments in the world, certainly one of the most well-resourced police departments in the world. And in fact, we have a very well-resourced, not only criminal justice system, but not-for-profit system, social service system, a huge homeless shelter system. And when you look around the cities around the country, we are a very well-resourced city in a variety of areas. And again, you know, if you have the ability to use resources wisely, you can get a lot of results. And New York City, I think, is a good example of that.
One of the common problems that we read about in the papers is that someone may be arrested on a serious charge and released right away, while someone else who poses little risk spends long and expensive stays in jail. How can that problem be rectified? Is that a bigger problem perhaps in New Orleans than it would be in New York or some of the other cities that have been more aware of it? Or is this just something that happens no matter where you are?
No. It's a bigger problem in New Orleans and certainly in a city like New York. And, you know, one of the areas that New York does have best practice in, two areas that we're particularly concerned about with New Orleans. One is, as I said, it has a very sophisticated bail agency that looks at people and makes a very good, solid, research-based recommendations on who's likely to come back to court for their appearance and who's not. So just that filters out a lot of those lower-level, non-risk to public safety people you're talking about.
The early case assessment and trial.
Well, right. Well, that's the pretrial agency. And then the early case assessment, which New Orleans is already starting to do, make sure that district attorneys and police officers talk in New York within 24 hours of an arrest. I mean, that is really national best practice to have those two agencies sit down and immediately make decisions. Is this a serious case? What more evidence do we need? Here's what you have to do. Or this isn't that serious a case. It's time to plead it out. Or, it's time to just dispose of this case in one way or another. You want to make those decisions, whether they're around violent cases or nonviolent ones, really early so you don't use your incarceration resources on people you don't have to, and to make sure for people who have committed violent crimes that you're doing everything in your power to convict them.
Practically everyone who's arrested in New Orleans is assigned a money bond while his or her case is pending. Why is that a problem?
Well, they do release some people on their own recognizance, but one of the reasons it's a problem for people to get money bonds is, again, especially in a city like New Orleans, but in a lot of cities where you have such high concentrations of poverty, having a money bond, especially any substantial money bond, is akin to just remanding you to jail. If those folks aren't going to make a money bond of $5,000 or $10,000, which is why you want to make sure that someone you have a money bond on and is spending a month in jail isn't someone who you could just have easily sent home who you'll be sure will come back to their court appearance next month. So setting money bond on some people, New York City sets money bond on thousands of people, but you want to make sure you're not setting money bond on everyone because that just works against your interests.
Do we monitor them to make sure that they'll come back when they're out on bail?
Oh, yeah. We don't just monitor them. We call them to remind them of their court appearance, to make sure they come back to their court appearance. Other cities like Washington, D.C., which is also a national best practice model in pretrial, will also supervise people in the community during their period of being out before their trial. So there are all sorts of things that you can do that are empirically based, that have very solid outcomes. And that's one of the areas we're encouraging New Orleans to pursue, again, both because it's good for public safety, but it will allow them to take their really constrained resources and move it up to the serious cases they really have to deal with.
Another problem you bring up is the limited use of problem-solving courts, like drug courts and mental health courts. Why are they being underutilized in New Orleans?
Well, New Orleans actually has a pretty good history using drug courts and mental health courts. And pre-Katrina, they had quite a number of them, and they were very proud of them, and deservedly so. They're much smaller in scope now. I think they have about 700, the drug courts, about 700 people or so, which is something, but not nearly enough. So I think there's two issues for those problems. One is I think they have to expand the use of those courts. And the other is in terms of problem-solving courts, in their municipal court, that's the court that essentially handles what would be here low-level misdemeanors or quality of life crimes. We thought problem-solving courts, courts that would sort of mete out low-level punishments, a lot of which, again, wouldn't be jail but would be community service, especially important in a city like New Orleans, again, modeled on some of the problem-solving courts that are in New York and other states and also in other countries, developed by the Center for Court Innovation, which is working with us on New Orleans, would be totally appropriate. And I think a problem-solving court or series of problem-solving courts in New Orleans makes a lot of sense given the volume of low-level cases that they see.
I'm sure there have been a lot of studies of the effect of alternative sentencing. How effective is it? Are the problems just when one of those people then goes on to commit a more terrible crime and suddenly everybody says we can't do this anymore?
Right. And, you know, as in all this stuff, you know, there's the substance and the politics, and you can never sort of forget, especially in criminal justice and in punishment, that those are interrelated. So there are wonderful alternative to incarceration, alternative to detention programs that have, again, much better public safety results than certainly short jail stays or short prison stays.
But we're seeing more and more people in New Orleans having those jail stays because they don't have any other way of dealing with these
problems.
That's
correct. They don't. They haven't developed the capacity to have those alternatives. And as you say, even in the best alternatives, right, they're better than jail or prison in most cases. But there will be a case. There will be some case when something happens, a high-profile case. And that's a shared risk that people in the system have to have. These are not no one's perfect anywhere in this system.
I'm sure that's something you had to deal with quite a bit when you were New York City Corrections Commissioner.
Sure.
How did this guy wind up on the streets?
Right. Well, and, you know, and more so in some ways when I was the city's probation commissioner, because, you know, we ran what I think of as very successful alternative to prison programs that had far better recidivism rates than just sending people to prison. But certainly, occasionally, one of those people in one of those programs would commit some high-profile crime, and people would say, well, if that person was in jail or prison on that day, that wouldn't have happened. And the tough thing about this field, is that's true. If that person was in jail or prison, that it wouldn't have happened. But if this program wasn't around, there'd be, in fact, less public safety rather than more. So part of the trick here is to find a way to talk to policymakers and citizens to convince them of the value of these, even recognizing that even in the best case, occasionally a high-profile incident will happen.
My guest is Michael Jacobson, former New York City's Corrections Commissioner and Probation Commissioner, now Director of the Vera Institute of Justice. We're talking about the Vera Institute's suggestions to New Orleans on how to correct their problems, although I'm assuming that you could put together a similar package for many cities.
Yeah,
Katrina just forced New Orleans
to
rethink its system.
That's right. And we, you know, work with cities and states certainly all over the country. And again, you know, New Orleans, especially post-Katrina, is just it's a very different challenge, certainly for us and certainly for the folks who run and work in the city. But, you know, again, even if you've never been there and you've read about it, or certainly if you've been there, it's so heartbreaking. The problems are so pressing that you just want to be able to sort of try to do something, to contribute something, and hopefully we'll be able to do that.
I remember when I visited New Orleans and I took a cab to go to a restaurant that was not in the center of town. The driver should have, by all the rules of New Orleans, gone on some highway and then come right off at the restaurant, but got lost, and we wound up going through some of the poorer neighborhoods. And I have to tell you, I was stunned to see how some people were living there, and that a city would countenance that kind of thing.
Yeah, and you know, as I mentioned before, and you know, the problems are so multifaceted here, which makes it so difficult, because the concentrated poverty that you're talking about is just a huge issue unto itself, and it's hard to separate the various systems here, the criminal justice system from the social services system from the health system, because that kind of poverty leads people to cross all those systems. So there's a tremendous amount of work to be done, and it's not like if we can just, you know, fix the criminal justice system a little, everything will be perfect. But it is, I think, an important start, but certainly not the only thing that New Orleans needs to look at.
Are there other areas of the system that could use reforming, but that you didn't address in your proposal because it just would have been too much?
Yeah, and we may eventually take an even broader look. But, you know, we try to be very realistic about how we work with other states and localities and not just give them, you know, a plan that says if you just did A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, you'd have a sort of utopian system here. I mean, that might be nice on a piece of paper, but it doesn't really do anyone any good. We want to set out things that are very doable, very important, that you can see progress on early, and that will, and if you can do that, that sort of sustains a reform effort that allows you to sort of cover more stuff than you originally start with.
Can we look to other countries for their solutions, or is the United States a unique situation?
You know, it's a really interesting question. It's
Sweden doesn't have a Second Amendment, for example.
Right. And you know, there's all sorts of really interesting practice in a variety of areas internationally. I think there are two issues with that. One is a sort of political issue, you know, this notion of American exceptionalism and, no one really has the scope or size or complexity of the problems we have, and what difference does it make if, you know, France or Italy or South Africa does some interesting thing, what does that have to do with us? Substantively, it has a lot to do with us because we have a lot to learn from a variety of countries. And, you know, we try to incorporate best practice wherever we see it. Some of it may be applicable to a complicated urban environment like New Orleans. Some won't. But, you know, the United States is not remotely the epicenter of all best practice in criminal justice, hardly.
Do you expect your proposals to be implemented by New Orleans?
We're pretty confident. We're going back down in a couple of weeks to spend a few days with all the city leadership and the people who run the criminal justice system. And our goal is to come out of that with, you know, a very specific work plan, very public commitments by all the actors to move ahead on this. And we're not, we're not sort of naive here. We know how difficult this is politically and practically. But, you know, we remain confident. You know, people, we've been completely impressed by people's, even in the face of really unimaginable obstacles, people's willingness to sort of move ahead with reform. So we are kind of confident.
I heard a report recently that people in New Orleans are so disillusioned that whoever is in power, Democrat or Republican, is likely to be voted out of power in the next election because they're all being blamed.
Right.
So this thing has to be done by the people who believe in it before the next election.
No, absolutely. And it's one of the reasons we wanted to concentrate very specifically on areas that we thought were both important and where you could make reforms. And people clearly are sort of bitter and feel abandoned and betrayed by, you know, all sorts of levels of government. And I think that's one of the reasons it's important for us and the city to sort of capitalize on this, you know, bit of momentum that's in the system now, because they and the citizens, I think, really want to see something happen. They're tired of people just talking about it.
So you have to get the mayor, Mayor Ray Nagin. You
right.
have to get the city council.
Right.
You have to get the judges.
Correct.
The police commissioner
right.
and members of the police force.
The sheriff.
All to sign on this.
That's correct. And that's, you know, again, even in the best case, it's not, you know, this is not just a New Orleans issue, whether it be New York City or anywhere else. Getting that to happen is difficult in any case, more difficult in New Orleans. But again, we've been sort of impressed by people's willingness to, even in the face of political obstacles, practical obstacles, to really try to get this done.
Because all you need is one or two sheriffs saying, this is all BS. This isn't going to work. This is Yankee thinking or whatever.
No, and you know, we're pretty clear when we do this work. We're not there. Vera, in this case, is not there to sort of fix your system. I mean, the people who run the system, who work and live in the system, they have to take the lead. They have to fix it. I think we can be really helpful. We can provide information and research and best practice and facilitate. But at the end of the day, this is a local issue, and the people who work there have to get this done.
And how does assessment of the changes take place? I mean, in New York, we've seen that our crime rate has gone down, and people are arguing over why that is, and nobody seems to agree. So if you implement this and things do improve, of course, you take total credit. All the people who are involved take total credit. And if things remain just as bad or get worse, then you take the blame?
Yeah, you know,
or you say, well, it's going to take more time.
Right. Well, you know, again, as I said early about a variety of things, but, you know, there's all sorts of shared possibilities here and shared risk. And, you know, this is not, you know, Vera's, even in the best case, if it worked tremendously. This is not ours to take the credit for, right? The credit, to the extent any of this works, the credit will go all to the folks who made it happen in New Orleans. The assessment piece is, a very good question. We always recommend looking at what you're doing, both through social science research and just outcome and performance measures, both because you always want to know what's happening and how you're doing, but because we also realize, you know, very few things work perfectly the first time you do them. You realize that when you set up a system that it made sense at the time, but now that we see what's happening, it makes sense to do this over there and do this later and do this earlier and have more resources there. So
because so many policies are reactive.
Correct. And, you know, and things change and, you know, there are things that you thought you knew but you didn't quite know. So, again, the way we work is you sort of set up these programs, we test them, we advise on policies, you like to see what's working, and even if it's not working, it doesn't mean it's a failure and you throw up your hands. You look at why it's not, and you revise it, and you get it to a place where it can work. So this is, as I said, it's not an easy, neat, tidy process, but it's an important process.
And in the case of New Orleans, it's going to be complicated by the fact that the city is rebuilding, and people will continue to move back or new people will move in and change the whole dynamic of the city.
Right. No, it's as you say, it's an amazingly dynamic sort of iterative environment. And it's not like there's a bubble around it and everything's going to stay the same and you can just sort of tinker around the edges. You're going to be doing reform as huge things change at the same time again, which is why it's so challenging. And if you allow yourself just to close your eyes and think about all the possible obstacles, you'll never get anything done.
Newark next, I assume. Michael Jacobson is the director of the Vera Institute of Justice, and they have been advising New Orleans on how to improve their system. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
On tomorrow's show, Steven Pinker on what words tell us about how the mind works, then what science can tell us about the mummies in the Brooklyn Museum's collection. Plus, Brooklyn Borough President Marty Markowitz and Brooklyn DA and crime novelist Charles Hines on the upcoming Brooklyn Book Festival, and Please Explain is all about HMOs. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Rory Bernstein, Scott Goldberg, and Jennifer Keeney-Sendro. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.